Welcome, dear readers. You are listening to Time to Read, a Winnipeg Public Library podcast book club. We are coming to you from our little hamlet, better known as the Carol Shields Auditorium, which is located on the grounds of WPL Castle, aka the Millennium Library. We are, of course, located on Treaty 1 territory and on land that is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. In this episode, we will discuss The Princess Bride by S. Morgan Stern. If there's a book you think we should discuss in the future, let us know at wpl-podcast@winnipeg.ca. If I remove my black mask, you'll find I'm Alan Chorney, branch head of the Transcona Library, and to my left is...
I am Dennis from the Idea Mill, and my love is like a storybook story. And across the table from me is...
Hi, I'm back. It's Kirsten from Harvey Smith Library, and I'm relating strongly to dictionary.com's word of the year, existential. And to my right is...
Hi, I'm Trevor. I'm clinging to the cliffs of insanity, halfway up, halfway down. And when I'm not doing that, I'm the branch head at the Louis Riel Library.
A good book can carry me away from an ever-urgent ordinary.
And you, dear readers, we couldn't do this without you. It's your questions and comments that form the heart of our discussion, so make us laugh or make us cry by emailing us at wpl-podcast@winnipeg.ca or leave a comment on our website, wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca. Find out if your comments made it on the air by subscribing to Time to Read on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, or other fine podcasting services. In a moment, Kirsten will start us off by giving us a brief bio of William Goldman, the actual author of The Princess Bride, followed by Dennis, who will spoil everything with a brief synopsis. Then it is on to the discussion, which you can get in on by emailing us at wpl-podcast@winnipeg.ca or finding us on Facebook. Don't forget to stick around to the end for a special segment, Nerd Words for Word Nerds. Kirsten?
Thank you. So yes, the bio of William Goldman, because of course Morgan Stern does not exist. William Goldman, born 1931 in Chicago. He was a novelist and screenwriter, probably more well-known as a screenwriter, as I learned as I was doing this research. And he died last year, November 16th. He was drafted into the Army after graduating with his BA, and he was assigned to the Pentagon because he knew how to type. That's all it takes to get into the Pentagon, I guess, at that time. And then he graduated with his MA from Columbia University in 1956. He wrote short stories throughout this time, but he failed to get anything published. He was actually one of the editors of Oberlin College's literary magazine, and he submitted stories to that magazine anonymously, but he still couldn't get a short story published. And the other editors had some quite unkind words about the pieces that he had submitted. He, of course, went on to be rather successful. He won Academy Awards for his screenplays Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men. He was, like I said, a prolific screenwriter. And out of the many, many films that he screen wrote for, he adapted many Stephen King's works like Misery, which I had no idea, Hearts in Atlantis, and Dreamcatcher. He has said that getting into a rhythm as a writer is important. And for him, that meant having coffee, reading the papers, turning on the computer, and checking out the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon of the day. He also said that, "I don't like my writing. I wrote a movie called Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and I wrote a novel called The Princess Bride. And those are the only two things I've ever written, not that I'm proud of, but that I can look at without humiliation." William Goldman.
Okay, the summary for The Princess Bride by William Goldman. I made this up entirely myself, so if it's no good, you know, blame it on me.
We can't blame Wikipedia.
And full spoilers on this one. Wesley and Buttercup live a simple life on a farm and fall in love. Wesley sails off to find his fortune so that he can properly marry Buttercup, but his ship is overtaken by a notorious pirate who never leaves survivors. Heartbroken, Buttercup eventually agrees to marry Prince Humperdinck rather than face execution, but she does not love him. Then she is kidnapped by people intending on murdering her, then kidnapped again by a masked stranger who turns out to be her lost love Wesley. They are captured by Humperdinck, who secretly tortures and then murders Wesley and plans to murder Buttercup after they wed. Unlikely alliances, and one miracle later, Wesley rescues Buttercup and they ride off into the sunset into eternal happiness. That's the story. Or at least, that's one of the stories, told within a bigger story about stories. It's a romance, it's an adventure, it's a revenge tale, it's a fairy tale, it's social commentary, and maybe it's something else too.
Nice job.
Good stuff. So The Princess Bride, how did you guys feel about coming into this book?
You know, I knew about the book after the movie came out because I saw the movie in theaters mm-hmm. when I was a kid. And this is one of those books that I've avoided reading for a long time because the movie is my favorite movie of all time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, you go see a movie and read the book like Fight Club. And the movie is much better than the book in that case, in my opinion.
Disagree, but I see what you're saying.
You're objectively wrong, Alan. It's widely agreed. And then there are other books and movies like To Kill a Mockingbird, where the movie is good, but the book is just too beautiful to compare. And I didn't want to sully the mm-hmm. experience of the movie in any way by being exposed to either a book that was so much better or so much worse. And so I was really kind of delighted that it holds up and stands both separate and together and just makes me feel better that I read the book now.
Yeah. I didn't actually realize that it was a book first. I saw the movie long, long time ago. I saw it again with my son when he was little. I just, you know, sometimes movies just exist as movies, and that's what I always thought it was. So it was sort of a surprise to me to delve into it, although I do admit that I didn't actually read the physical book. I listened to the audiobook. Which is an abridged version.
The Rob Reiner.
And read by Rob Reiner. Yes.
How was it?
It was pretty good. I read a review about it where it said like that they thought Rob Reiner was reading it like a parent that's really rushing through a bedtime story trying to get to the end. And that sort of stuck with me as I was listening to it because I thought that actually added to it because I think a lot of us as parents have been there. I thought it was enjoyable, and all the funniest parts or the best parts of the movie come right from the book, and that was quite delightful.
You know, what's cool about that, too, is the book in many ways is a story about storytelling, and so to experience it in all different formats, whether it's a movie, whether it's a book, whether it's an audiobook, it's cool. Like, the story shines through no matter what the medium is.
Yeah, exactly. And
for me, I think I'm in the minority because I never saw this movie till, I'd say, recently, like in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I never saw it as a kid.
Yeah.
And I rewatched it maybe a month ago, 2 months ago. So it was fresh in my mind when I read the book. And so I don't have the same kind of nostalgic attachment to the movie that many, many, many people do. I'm sure mm-hmm. we'll talk about that later, about the pop culture significance the movie has. So I was coming into it more, I wouldn't say indifferent, but just sort of more clinical. I saw the movie, I enjoyed it. And then I was interested in reading what the book was. And again, like sort of Dan said, I was very pleased that the spirit and the feeling of the movie is in the book and vice versa, and which may have to do with the fact that William Goldman also wrote the screenplay mm-hmm. for the movie. So he was right there through the process. But yeah, I just was reading it and thinking like, okay, yeah, this is really fun. It's very similar to the feel of the movie, but yeah. And that's fine. And I enjoyed both.
Although you did give me your copy of the book so that I could finally at least have a look through the book version. And you hadn't finished it. You said, oh, well, there was just too much of like.
Okay. Well, yeah. I didn't want to clarify. I finished the book proper, but the edition that I had, I think it's the same one that Alan had.
Yeah. It has like Buttercup has, like, Baby.
Like all kinds. Like there's this written chapter. And I was thinking like, this thing's got more appendices than Lord of the Rings. And yes. I was like, I don't need to. I've had enough. Like I enjoyed it. I don't think I need to read about Buttercup's Baby.
To be fair, Buttercup's Baby was only added to the 25th anniversary of the book. So you're off the hook on that, okay. Trevor.
So I can pretend I'm a hipster and I had some copy, the 1973 copy.
Well, because the copy I had didn't have the Buttercup's Baby thing. Okay. I think that he had started writing the sequel, right? And that was Buttercup's Baby?
Well, if you read I don't know if he actually like literally started writing the sequel or if he was in his pretend William Goldman talking about writing the sequel, but who knows if he was actually starting to write the sequel.
Well, according to Cary Elwes in that book he wrote about the making of the movie, he had tried to write a sequel, but he just couldn't do it. And so I think that's, you can't take his word in the book itself because When I was in high school, after we'd watched the movie, a friend of mine had read the book, and she was telling us all about how it's actually a really old book, and like she bought into the whole story, right? And it had been edited, and all this other stuff was in there. And so when I read through it, it was like, oh, okay, she bought all.
Because
you can't tell. He's kind of convincing until he keeps bringing up things like that Florin and Gilder were real countries and that there are scholars about them and things like that that clue you in that it's supposed to be a joke.
And then some of the extraneous stuff, he talks about visiting Florin. I don't know if that was in your edition, Denzi. He goes and visits the library there, and then he gets into a pretend feud with Stephen King because
Is that
Stephen King was then hired to write a screenplay, or
Stephen King was hired to abridge the sequel.
So he's got, at the end of the 25th edition, I guess, he's got Buttercup's Baby, an explanation. There's this whole thing about an explanation, and then it actually goes into Buttercup's Baby.
I don't think I ever got past the explanation.
Is
that
King
where my bookmark was?
Was
somewhere around
this is my bookmark. What about you?
Well, sort of similar to Trevor. I hadn't seen the movie growing up as a kid, so I don't have like all of those attachments to it, and I didn't see it like a bajillion times. I saw it once in my early 20s, and I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was a really good movie, which is interesting because other movies that I know people are attached to, like Labyrinth, as great as David Bowie is, like I saw it as an adult, and I was like, it's okay. But then reading this book, I really remembered much more of the movie than I thought I did, or the movie played more in my mind than I thought usually happens in this sort of situation.
I was listening to it, I was like, wow, I'm remembering way more of this movie than I thought I would.
And what I enjoyed about the book too was that in the movie, the two times I saw it, I felt like the three bandits, their stories were just not really fleshed out enough for me to care about them. Fezzik and Inigo and Montoya and
the Sicilian.
But yet in the novel, I liked how we went back and we got to see their origins and understood how Fezzik became who he was, or the whole backstory of how Inigo Montoya was training. And I think that there was a better payoff for me when I read the book when we finally had that final confrontation between the six fingered man and him. And in the movie, I was just like, well, okay, this means something to him, but it doesn't mean anything to it doesn't mean anything to me, sort of, but I
kind of thought that was hilarious in the movie because he'd always say, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die. And I thought it was funny because you didn't quite have the context of that, but he kept on saying it. So I thought that was kind of funny in the film.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the film was definitely made lighter than the book. Like when you read the book, and you read the stories of Inigo and Fezzik and Vicini, you realize that these are extremely dangerous people who have all killed lots of people separately. And it's clear, too, that Wesley, as the Dread Pirate Roberts, had killed a lot of people, too. And you kind of, in the movie, it's easy to gloss over. But in the book, these are all extremely dangerous people, like the most dangerous people in the world, all of them.
Like, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that.
Explain.
Well, I mean, in the sense that, like, when you read Marvel comics or whatever, which are aimed at kind of a younger demographic, and, you know, they're smashing up New York City, and you're like, you know, there is a lot of collateral damage here that never actually happens in the Marvel universe kind of thing. So I kind of felt it was the same way. Yeah. They're dangerous, but I wasn't like, I don't think I feared them in the book. I took it as pretty lighthearted, I think.
Well, because there was magic to be able to access, you know, to bring someone back to life. So,
but that was also really an uncommon thing.
You know? What did death really mean?
But just to follow what Alan said about Marvel, that in the 80s, there was a limited series. I think it was a 4-issue series called Damage Control. It was all about the crews that are sent out to, deal with the property damage after a superhero fight. And it's so they're all non-superheroes. They're just like construction guys and remediation specialists. And so it's kind of a fun side of superhero movies you don't always think about. That, after like a fight between Thor and whatever, Yeah, there's going to be some serious, you know,
carnage
there. It's going to take a while to clean that up.
Amanda on Facebook actually agreed with you, Trevor, what you were talking about, like delving into the characters a little bit deeper, because she said that she read the book back in high school, which I just, think is great, because most people have just seen the movie. So anyway, read the book back in high school, loved it. My favorite character would be Fezzik, because the book covers more of his story than the movie does. So yeah, she would agree with you.
Oh, that's...
Going back to Dennis's point, though, the interesting thing, though, is, which I didn't notice until like halfway through the book, is this isn't cataloged as YA. This is adult fiction, whereas we have the movie in our juvenile collection here at the library. So I guess we could talk a little bit more about, do you think this is an adult novel? Like, or like, would kids pick it up?
I think this book has a lot of levels to it, so it's pretty easy to be something that kids can enjoy. I mean, I don't know that kids would enjoy the parts where Goldman is going on about the whole process about his son and his wife and the finding the book and going to the editing phase and things like that. But if you do a Goldman and skip that part when you're reading it to the kids, the story itself works perfectly well. And then you can leave out all the little asides and stuff like that. And then as an adult, that meta commentary is a little more meaningful, especially when you get to the end and he's talking and he essentially gives you multiple choices.
Yeah.
Like, well, Morgenstern said that, all of a sudden all these dangerous things started happening right at the end. And then he says, well, you could have the happy ending. Or you could have the realistic one where eventually they gain some weight, they start arguing and bickering, Fezzik lose and Indigo lose fights, and that's kind of the dreary, this is what real life would be, but yeah.
I wonder if anyone actually does that with this book, where they read it to their kid, but just skip out all of the William Goldman asides and parts.
It would hold up.
Yeah, they should. Let's tell folks to do that.
As parents of Winnipeg, yes. Please do this with your children.
Yeah.
Do the Rob Reiner edit.
That's whatever. Right. Skip over all the italicized.
It's funny, Alan, when you're talking about, is this an adult book or a book for kids? When I started reading it, the first book that came to mind for me was Slaughterhouse-Five. Mm-hmm. Because if you remember in that, the first chapter is very meta, where Kurt Vonnegut is, or a version of Kurt Vonnegut, is talking directly to the reader and talking about, what a terrible time he had coming up with this book. And so, William Goldman takes it to the extreme degree. But it was the same kind of framing device, I thought. And it was interesting when I looked up the publication dates. These books were published with just a very few years of each other. Mm-hmm. So they could very possibly have been on bookshelves at the same time, but very, very different tones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But similar structures, I thought.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how writers will bring themselves into the work or bring a version of themselves. What I was thinking, I was like, is there something that this is reminding me of? And I didn't think of it until we just sat down. But the film adaptation with Nicolas Cage, written by Charlie Kaufman and Donald Kaufman, and he writes himself and his twin brother into the movie, except Donald Kaufman doesn't actually exist.
Mm-hmm. And that's a crazy movie. I just remember seeing it, where it was based on The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean. Yeah. And then like Meryl Streep, I think, plays a version of Susan Orlean in it. And it would be worth a rewatch.
So one of the things we asked was, or talked about, was there was a lot of quotable quotes in the book. I don't know if anyone had any favorite sayings or anything that stood out to them particularly, or I guess from the movie too.
The funny thing about the book is that it's almost impossible to separate from the movie in my mind, and I'll have a quote in my head and I won't remember whether it was from the movie and the book or just one of them. The line with between Vicini and Inigo, when Vicini says again, inconceivable, and Inigo responds, that word you use, I do not think it means what you think it means.
That's exactly what, that was my choice.
It's the best line ever.
It's so funny because to me it's like a little mini nerd word segment. right in the text.
And my other favorite moment in the movie particularly, and it's also mostly there in the book, just different characters saying certain lines, but when they're storming the castle and they need to get the gate key, and the Willem or whatever the gatekeeper guy's name
Yellen.
Is. Yellen. Yellen, that's it. He said, oh, I have no gate key. Fezzik, rip his arms off. Well, you mean this gate key? I just love that moment.
I think for me, the line that stands out that I like is when the man in black is dueling with Inigo. And he says, Inigo says something, and then the man in black says, get used to disappointment. I just got, or is that what it says?
Well, it's
I got it wrong.
Indigo asks him, "Who are you?" After seeing his virtuosity, and he's like, "No one of consequence." He goes, "I must know. Get used to disappointment."
Right. Yeah.
I think my favorite line comes in the beginning where Buttercup's just realizing her love for Wesley. And she goes, "I have loved you for several hours now and every second more." And I thought, I was like, that's such a great line. And I'm like, man, like, I feel like that might be a, like, if I were sitting in a bar and someone came up to me and said, "I have loved you for several hours now," I think my heart would melt onto the floor.
All right, folks, you heard it here. You see Alan at a bar. That's the way to get to his heart. I had written down also, true love is the best thing in the world, except for cough drops.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Was that in the movie as well? I just remember hearing it on the audio and thinking, that's awesome.
In the movie,
I love it.
Billy Crystal ad-libbed the line and instead of cough drop said, "except for MLT, a mutton, lettuce, tomato chat."
Oh, okay. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently that whole scene with Billy Crystal, he and Carol Kane, they improvise just a lot of lines constantly over the filming. And just Rob Reiner actually had to leave the set for some of it so that his laughing wouldn't keep interrupting the takes.
Were they the ones too that said, "Have fun storming the castle"?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's also good.
I can admit that I'm not really the biggest Billy Crystal fan. I think he's probably my least favorite part of the movie. I kind of found his character kind of annoying in the film.
Well, when Miracle Max, comes on the screen for me, it was like, oh, that's Billy Crystal. Like, in a way, it kind of took me out of the movie a bit because aside from him, none of the other actors were really, to me anyway, like iconic or well known. They were cast because of their looks or their acting ability. But you know, that time I didn't know anything about Mandy Patinkin or
Andre the Giant.
Well, Andre the Giant. Again, like, I mean, I did see the movie only about 5 years ago, so I knew who Mandy Patinkin was from like
at
Homeland or something.
Yeah,
but you know, Billy Crystal, I could see. I guess maybe it's just because was he and Rob Reiner friends, or how did he get cast in? Like, it's
most of the actors were connected to Rob Reiner in some way. Like, he knew like Christopher Guest, who's
from Spinal Tap.
From Spinal Tap, and there was a couple of other Spinal Tap connections amongst the crew and film. Most of the actors were reasonably well known at the time, except for the younger cast like Cary Elwes and Robin Wright.
Yeah, we asked social media too about favorite characters as well, and lots of people said Wesley.
That's
Wesley,
true.
Although they spelt it Wesley.
Wesley. Oh,
yeah, Adam Ziegler said, "I've read both the book and watched the movie. Wesley is the best character because of his flamboyant attitude. It's both my favorite book and my favorite movie, but I will not swoon over it here."
And Charlie Nellum also said on Instagram, "I have read the book and watched the movie. This was one of those very, very rare occasions when I enjoyed the movie way more than the book. Wesley is my favorite."
Yeah. Lots of votes for Wesley.
Yeah.
Speaking of characters, I read a funny little bit. It's probably what you read too, Dennis, in the Cary Elwes' book about Rob Reiner asking Cary Elwes' advice for casting British actors, because Cary Elwes was a Brit, and he asked him who he should cast for the minister in the scene, the marriage scene. Mm-hmm. And Cary Elwes' favorite British actor was Michael Palin. And he said, oh, he would be the best for it, and gave him the script. He read it and loved it, but didn't want to do it because at that time he was also filming someone with a speech impediment in a fish called Wanda. And he didn't want to kind of be typecast as a guy that has a speech impediment. So he turned it down, and then they got Peter Cook, I think, who did it. But another little behind the scenes.
I was delighted to find out that that was written that way in the book too, because I wasn't sure if that was something they just did as a gag for the movie, or you know.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that is that like Peter Cook's like shtick, you know. And then,
it's not.
Didn't include that in the audiobook though, that part.
No,
because I remembered that from the marriage.
Oh man, that was such a brilliant moment. Yeah.
So life is not fair, and it has never been, and it's never going to be. You guys feel that way about life? That's one of the things we asked.
Absolutely.
Yep.
That's
it. Case closed. Nothing more to discuss here.
But yeah. It's interesting that that would come out in a fairy tale setting, which in fairy tales, things always do work out. And, you know, the princess is rescued and everyone rides off into the sunset.
Lives so happily ever after.
Right. So, I mean, I feel like it's William Goldman's little dig at the subverting the genre by, you know, putting that out there.
Yeah.
Well, that line, you know, life is pain, highness, everyone who tells differently is selling something. Even when I was, you know, 16, that line connected with me right away. Like at the end where he gave the alternate endings of how it could have worked out, especially the realistic ending where, you know, they start bickering and like life happens. It reminded me of that book by, I'm going to forget the author now. But it was called After the Ecstasy, The Laundry. It was by a Buddhist writer, and he was talking about how, you know, people go off to like Buddhist retreats and they meditate and they have these moments. They have like epiphanies. They feel like they're coming towards enlightenment, and you come back from that. And no matter what your experience was, no matter how golden it was, the daily things in life, like your laundry, they still have to get done. You still have to wash the dishes. You still have to figure out your grocery plan for the week and things like that. And that stuff is usually just kind of skipped over in fairy tales and in lots of types of books and the movies and things like that. But it's always there. So I like the nod to it in this otherwise pure fantasy thing.
Yeah, and it came up again and again. So I think it definitely was a theme of the book. Yeah,
and even in the framing story to Bill Goldman, or I called him Bill in my head.
I've never seen him referred to as Bill.
Well, because anyway. I needed to make him, this is dad call him Billy. His dad calls him Billy a few times in there. But I needed to differentiate the character Bill Goldman from the actual screenwriter William Goldman some way, and so I called him Bill throughout the story. But even his framing story in the book, I don't think necessarily ends particularly fairly or happily for him anyway. And, you know, especially if you go into the Buttercup's baby segment and how he doesn't get to write the sequel and how he has all these legal troubles from Morgan Stern's estate afterwards and all that sort of fun stuff. So he could have made the story end well for him.
And I think in going back to Carrie Alwes's memoir, I think he and other people in that book refer to him as Bill as well. So you're not completely off base by doing that.
You and Carrie.
Yeah. Since we're mentioning Carrie Alwes's book a bunch, it was titled
As You Wish,
Inconceivable Tales from the Making of the Princess Bride. And I found out about it because one of our coworkers posted a blog to the library's website. Not long after we had decided to do this book.
Yes, and the week before our blog post promoting this book came out.
In fact, when I saw the headline of the blog post, I thought, oh, Ellen's post is up early. And I clicked on it. I was like, wait a second. This is something totally not related, but completely, totally on point.
But since our coworker Eileen had brought up this book and I subsequently read it, and we had decided that we wanted to get a bit of her feedback into the book and movie and her experience with it. So we got her to record a little segment that I'm going to play now.
So when I think of The Princess Bride, I think of my childhood. My dad introduced my sister and I to the film when we were young, and we enjoyed the sword fighting, the hilarious characters, and I was terrified of the ROUSs. As I grew up, we continued to watch the film, and I appreciated the more adult humor, and even more so Billy Crystal's and Carol Kane's performances as Miracle Max and his wife Valerie. As a family, we often quote from the film, though to be fair, my dad often quotes from many films we watched when we were younger, but this one in particular, he will recite scenes should the occasion arise. One of his favorite quotes from the film is, "Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling you something." I don't really know why this quote spoke to him, but he still uses it to this day, and fairly often. This is why my sister and I, when we were older and found it on DVD, knew we had to purchase a copy for my dad, and he loved it. The Princess Bride is a film that has influenced popular culture, has resonated with people young and old, and also, I believe, has aged fairly well. When it is on TV, I will sit and watch it, and, if I'm with my dad and sister, we will recite our favorite quotes, doing our best impressions of the characters, but most of all, we will be laughing, cheering, and yes, even tearing up a bit. Though mostly from laughter. Oh, and now I don't mind so much the ROUSs, nor the kissing parts.
So thanks, Eileen, for contributing that. That was great.
That was great. Yeah.
It's interesting hearing someone's perspective who kind of grew up with it, and it was part of what brought their family together was this movie or this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I want to just now also just read something that came to us through social media that kind of speaks to that, mm-hmm. You know, how our loved ones often will turn us on to a book or a movie. So this is from Ms. D.S. Menagerie, and she writes, "I have to post this. My husband, Jason, showed me this movie after I asked him why he always said, 'as you wish,' to me. Later, in our marriage, we decided to read it. My husband and I used to read books together often. He would read first, then I would, as I was a much slower reader. Our last read was this novel. He finished it and would pester me often, saying, 'Did you finish it yet? I have something I want to tell you about this book.' I hadn't finished. I had started university in 2010, so I put off reading the book. He continued to bug me, 'Just finish so I can tell you that thing.' He died in 2012. I didn't finish the book at the time, nor did I find out what he wanted to tell me. I still haven't finished. So, yeah, no life. It's fair, but it's still beautiful."
Yeah.
Thanks so much for sharing that. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, that's quite the...
Yeah, I mean, so that speaks to also the whole, yeah, life, is life fair? I mean,
absolutely not.
No, but life is still beautiful in its way, and yeah.
I wonder if she ever will finish the book, or whether it'll just be sort of something that just always, by not finishing it, it sort of somehow leaves that part of her life just a little bit open or something. Yeah. I wonder what I would do in that situation. Mm-hmm. Would I read it and then sort of, would that give me closure, or would that somehow be betraying my husband by not, yeah, I don't know. That's
trying to figure out that one thing.
Yeah. Like Rainbow Rolls, three last words, whatever, in Errol Aaron Park. And
right. Yeah.
But it really speaks to how stories connect us and stick in our memory long after you've read them or talked about them.
Mm-hmm.
The good ones do anyway.
Yeah. Well, sometimes really bad ones do too.
That's also true.
My wife and I still talk about the time we watched The Box movie, which was based on a Stephen King story, which I think it remains the worst movie I've ever seen.
Was that the Richard Kelly movie? Was he the director?
I don't remember directors. No.
I wonder if that was one of the Stephen King screenplays written by William Goldman.
I don't think it was. I don't think so.
But, you know, speaking of William Goldman, I sort of had my own Princess Bride moment with one of his scripts, and it was the script for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And I remember watching that movie a bunch of times with my dad as a kid. And I think my dad only showed me the good parts because, like, I thought it started with the train robbery. And I remember that. And the only things I really remember are the train robbery and then the conversation leading and the whole scene leading up to the cliff jump. And those were the two scenes that really stood out for me. And so then, like, as an adult, I rewatched the movie and I was like, what's all this like long, boring, weird stuff at the beginning? This isn't the movie. And so I don't know whether I'm just remembering the good parts or whether I actually saw some kind of like a curated version. So I thought that was kind of, that's what made me think of when it was the idea of just showing us the good parts.
Yeah. Well, and just hearing Eileen talk about her family, you know, watching the movie together and then sharing those quotes together over dinner. I mean, that happens a lot at our house too. And we have this really great kind of memory of us all going to see Sound of Music together. And then I saw it like years later and I had the same sort of idea that, oh my God, it's so long. Like, when does the exciting stuff happen? Like, I didn't remember it being so incredibly long. I remembered us like weeping and, you know, singing, and we've brought up the stories again and again and again. But then the actual movie, when I went back to them, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like 3 hours long.
I've heard of some cases of parents only showing the movie up to the wedding scene. And then it's a shorter movie and then it's less Nazis,
right?
You know, in the second half or whatever. But it's interesting you should mention The Sound of Music, because I did an informal poll of my staff about movies that they find rewatchable. And one of my staff, Ruta, said The Sound of Music. And she said it's weird, though, because she doesn't like musicals.
Yeah.
But some reason that movie it spoke to her, you know? And another staff member, Rube, he went for the series. He said every Christmas he watches Lord of the Rings series. He's always watching the Star Wars series and James Bond series. So those are his kind of comfort food touchstone movies.
Yeah.
And Yeah, and Robin mentioned National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, which was also popular with another couple of our listeners. Jamie Vibrick said Christmas Vacation and Dirty Dancing is her choices. So yeah, there's lots of things, a lot of variety out there that people would like to revisit.
So Kirsten, you were mentioning earlier that you don't generally rewatch films very often.
No, I don't.
Do you reread books?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't do that either.
Sometimes she doesn't even read them the first time.
Yeah, that's true too. But and again, it's a family thing, but we often will go over like Kids in the Hall again and again, certain skits around the table, or like I said, Sound of Music or West Side Story. Ooh. Like I think I've only seen that once, but like, and I saw it when I was 10 or 9 or even younger. I was in grade 3 and I remember then acting it out when I went back into class singing Maria. And but I only watched it that one time, but it comes back again. So I rewatch it, I guess, in my mind.
I'm pretty sure that's an accurate portrayal of gangs in New York in the 1960s. Lots of bright colors. Choreography.
Yeah, that's interesting. Dennis, do you rewatch, reread media?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy probably at least a half dozen times, and I've seen Princess Bride at least a dozen times over the years, and rewatched it this past week too, and I still laugh at all of the same points, and I get excited about a scene that's coming up, and the whole thing just lights up all of the pleasure centers in the brain.
Aww.
A few other movies like Fight Club.
Also lights up the pleasure centers in your brain.
It lights up different things, but you know, it's one that I've watched a whole bunch of times, but I wouldn't reread that book because I was a little disappointed in the book.
I'll admit the movie has a better ending, but I thought the book was pretty good.
And I don't know whether this is just something subconscious for me, but looking across the table at you, Alan, I'm thinking that one of the movies that I always watch is Empire Strikes Back. And that might be because you're wearing an Empire Strikes Back t-shirt right now, but that's one that I seem to always go to. I don't know. I've seen that one. I can't even tell you how many times.
It is the crown jewel in the Star Wars saga, I think.
Yeah.
And it has the, uncertain ending.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah. I know a lot of times we want our stories to be resolved, but sometimes that lack of resolution is not a bad thing.
And it has my favorite planet in all of Star Wars, the ice planet Hoth, because I feel like I live there about 8 months of the year.
So would you guys recommend The Princess Bride? Well, here, recommend.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Don't be like me and avoid it for years because you think you'll be disappointed. If you like the movie, you will like the book.
I often have that fear of media or books. I think we talked about this a little bit during... now I'm blanking on what we read last time. The Butler
Remains
one.
Of the, day.
The Remains of the Day, right? Because I didn't want to read it because I like Never Let You Go so much. So
and how you've been a bit funny with the Orcs and Craig series.
Right, yeah. Still a bit funny with the Orcs and Craig series. we sort of talked about this a little bit, but the historical time or the place and the time of this book is never really mentioned. So it takes place in the made-up land of Florin. Florin, am I getting that right? And some sort of America exists, so it can't be that far in the past. So that sort of thing.
But it was before Europe existed. Like it was. You know.
Fencing was a big thing, so that also kind of puts it into a certain context. So you're looking at 1700s, 1800s, around there.
Yeah.
Well, I was debating about whether this would be my nerd word or not, but as I was reading, I discovered there's actually a name for this type of genre. It's called a Ruritanian romance. It's named as, it's a genre of literature, film, or theater comprising novel stories, plays, and films set in a fictional country, usually in Central or Eastern Europe, such as the Ruritania that gave its name. And so one of the authors that wrote a lot of it was Anthony Hope. And his probably most famous novel turned into a movie called The Prisoner of Zenda. It takes place in Ruritania, which is a fictional European country of some undetermined past time. And Hergé, who wrote the Tintin series, he used, he made a couple of countries, Sildavia in King Ottokar's Scepter, again, a very European flavored country of a certain era. And so even Frances Hodgson Burnett, she wrote a book, The Lost Prince. So anyway, I thought, wow, you know, there's a label for everything. And so Ruritanian romance is what this type of thing is called.
That's like Patrick DeWitt's under major domo minor. It's also like in this sort of medieval country that's unnamed of a time period that you sort of
I think you touched on a rotating romance.
I think so.
There's that video game Papers, Please, which takes place in the communist European country Estruska, I think. I might have pronounced it wrong or remembered it wrong.
I always wanted to play that game. Mm. Have you played it?
It is extremely depressing.
That's kind of why I wanted to play it.
It's very effective in giving you a sense of what it might have been as a bureaucrat in a communist country.
You work as a passport stamper or a border person. So it's your job, and these people come in and you have to decide, are they allowed to come into the country or are they not allowed to come into the country?
Yeah, and you get penalized because it's like people come through and their height doesn't match their apparent height, and you know, you got to check the stamp, make sure it was issued in the right city. And
this does not sound fun.
No, it isn't, because after playing it for a while, you're anxious and your shoulders are tightening up, and you're like, you want to see a video game give you, you know, kind of a depressive, anxious feel, then that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because we think of video games, it has the word game in it, and that automatically, you know, elicits joy or thoughts of joy. But, you know, it's video games are a medium like any other, and there are video games that will make you sad or scare you or depress you or all sorts of things.
So now we need a Princess Bride video game.
That's with a meta narrative all around it.
Yeah.
So you've probably heard of Netflix, but do you know about Bookflix? Bookflix is one of the many databases available to you through Winnipeg Public Library's website. It reinforces early reading skills and introduces children to a world of knowledge and exploration by pairing classic video storybooks with related nonfiction ebooks to build a love of reading and learning. Sound interesting? Check it out by going to our website, winnipeg.ca/library, and clicking on the Databases button in the middle of the page. Click on the Bookflix link and enter your library card information if prompted. Then you're all set to check out a variety of stories that are sure to delight and enchant.
But now it's time to segue into our most awkwardly worded segment. Can you tell me a book you would also like?
And weren't we going to talk about a book?
I've got like three things going on here.
Oh, right. We totally were.
2020, what's coming up? What are we excited about?
This whole awkward thing where I totally...
forgot what we were actually
Yes. Something we're looking forward to reading. But it's okay. I got it.
Do you want to redo that
intro? I think it's great, as awkward as it is.
So we're just going to leave this in without editing it.
Yeah. Right. Unless you guys really want to edit it.
We'll see how the spirit strikes me later.
Well, I have a couple of books that I am looking forward to reading. And one of them is coming out in 2020, but one is already out, 2019. So the first one is Empire of Wild by Cherry DeMaline, who, of course, wrote The Marrow Thieves, which I loved. And as someone who isn't into dystopian books, but I really love that one. And I've just heard raves about this book. My friend Tracy was just visiting, and she's a prof who teaches at the School of Native Studies at U of A, actually teaches a course on Indigenous erotica, and she adores this book and couldn't say enough good things about it. So it's set in small towns, reservations, graveyards, and Walmart parking lots in and around Georgian Bay, where Sherry grew up. Empire of Wild is a gritty love story and chilling mystery, as well as an exploration of Indigenous life in Ontario today, from family dynamics to ongoing oppression. Also, I like this review too, because it talked about, amidst the smart cultural critique, there are some quiver-inducing sex scenes. So, you know, also is like, pleasure parts of my brain.
Happy New Year.
So that's Empire of Wild by Cherry DeMaline, and you can put that on hold at the library right now. And then the other book that I'm looking forward to reading, it hasn't been released yet. It'll be released in the spring of 2020, The Glass Hotel by Emily St. John Mandel, who wrote, of Horror Station 11. So even as I say, I don't like dystopian novels, there was another one that I really enjoyed. So it's another highly imaginative novel, really beautifully written is what I've read so far in the initial reviews. But it's more straight literary fiction and not so much speculative. So of course, that appeals to me as well. And I guess there are a couple of characters from Station 11 that show up in the Glass Hotel. So that's kind of interesting. And it also explores the idea of parallel universe that was also touched on a bit in Station 11. So it's about the intersection of two major events, a massive Ponzi scheme collapse and the mysterious disappearance of a woman from a ship at sea.
I'm a little disappointed that she didn't call it Station 12.
So that's my other book that I'm looking forward to reading in the new year.
And I think I came up with the idea for this segment, and I don't think I fully understood it either, whether we were trying to think of books that we want to read that are being published next year or just books that we are already published. So I have one of each.
Okay.
So the one that hasn't been published yet, but I'm looking forward to, is coming out in February 2020. It's called The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, who we may remember wrote Devil in the White City. Mm-hmm. And what this is just a one-year account. It starts on May 10th. 1940, which was the first day that Winston Churchill became prime minister, and goes through to May 10th, 1941, which was the final and most intense night of the German Blitz. So throughout that year, it follows Winston Churchill as prime minister and leading the country and the world against Hitler and Germany. But at the same time, things going on in his home life and his family. So, and we know how Eric Larson can really take nonfiction and make it sound like a thriller. So I'm really looking forward to it. My one reservation is apparently it's 608 pages. Whether I actually do get to it, we'll see. And then the other one was just a book I've always been meaning to read. You know, every dang month we're here in the Carol Shields auditorium. I've never read a Carol Shields book. So I'm thinking in 2020, maybe my resolution will be I will read a Carol Shields book. And I don't know which one to read. I don't know. So, you know, listeners, if you have recommendations or if you good
unless.
People... Unless is that yeah. that's one of them? Okay, great. I'm not gonna tie myself to a particular title at this point, but I will read a Carol Shields book.
So that's, tell us your best, WPL-podcast@winnipeg.ca.
Right. That's good what I got.
So speaking of big long books, and I guess my vision of how this segment worked, in that I have no concept of books in the future. I never think about upcoming books.
You're like an infant. You got like object permanence.
It's just like it's like those old TBS commercials where they would show reruns during the summer, and it would be like, if you haven't seen it, it's new to you. So I'm like, if I haven't read it, it's new to me. So I have this like amorphous list of books that I want to read. And one of the books is a 1,000-page tome that made me think of, I guess, The Princess Bride. And if there were a book that was The Princess Bride, that was abridged into The Princess Bride and actually existed, it would be this book, which features love and revenge and pirates and treasures and history and history and history and all in a book so long it probably could use a William Goldman abridgment. I'm recommending The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas. And yeah, so I was like, maybe it is the Princess Bride, you know, there's a lot of similarities in there. And also props to the 2002 movie adaptation starring Guy Pearce. Love that.
So that's like the opposite of a brand new book is the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes, but I've never read it, so it's new to him.
Similarly, I don't look forward to books that aren't published yet because I don't pay much attention to publishing news. Earlier this year, we did a few sci-fi books, and it reawakened my interest in reading sci-fi again. And there's a series that I have heard much about over the years. Whenever I'd be reading a forum and we'd be talking about sci-fi books that people loved, inevitably, the Culture series by Ian M. Banks comes up, and people talk about it in ways that make me interested in reading it, even if I don't fully understand what's involved in the series. But apparently, it's talking about a future in which, I can't even encapsulate exactly what I've heard about, but there's something called the Culture, and the books don't approach the culture directly. They tell stories in which you kind of see reflections of the culture, which is the society of the time. And just that kind of vagueness and the way people love it is what's made me interested in reading it. So the first book in the series is called Consider Phlebas. So I'm going to try to tackle that one this year at some point.
Cool.
Interesting list. Very good.
And if you want to let us know what you want to look forward to reading in 2020, you can also let us know. WPL-podcast@winnipeg.ca.
I think we have a question up on our Facebook page about that.
We do, right?
Yeah. To be read?
Proud of my Canva
that
artwork.
That was you?
Well, I took a template and I filled with it a wee bit.
But that was good.
I did.
It's your abridgment of the template. And now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, Nerd Words for Word Nerds, the part of each show where our hosts boil down their most prevalent thoughts of the past month into one word. And since Erica is not here, who wants to go first?
Why does Erica always go first?
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost seems always. Like she does. Yeah.
Oh, she just jumps in. Okay, well, I'm going to jump in because this is sort of the time of year that is just a great time of year for word nerds, because there are lots of words of the year lists. And so I think there's been lots written about Merriam-Webster Dictionary said that they was the word of the year. Super interesting. Oxford Dictionary said climate emergency. Collins Dictionary said climate strike was their word of the year. Dictionary.com, I think I alluded to this in my opening, said that existential was their word of the year. And so it made me actually think about other countries. So I'm German. And so I thought, well, I wonder if other countries have words of the year. So bear with me. But I'm going to just talk about Germany's in second place. Their word of the year is roller chaos.
Whoa.
Refers to the numerous e-scooters found throughout Germany since June, when their usage became officially came into law. The increasingly popular scooters became a problem in many German cities because they're often used aggressively and parked in places where they shouldn't be. Roller chaos. But then there's in China, more than 12 million Chinese and Taiwanese chose the Chinese character kun, meaning trapped, as their word of the year. In Norway, the word most talked about was vindkraft, or wind power. In Australia, their third most popular word of the year was JOMO, joy of missing out.
Ooh.
Which I think I am going to
flips the script.
I know, right? Too. Grab onto that one.
JOMO sounds way more fun than FOMO.
JOMO. Nari Shakti was named the Hindu word of the year, derived from the Sanskrit Nari, woman, and Shakti, power, which is also another really kind of cool one.
Spice Girls.
And oh, I'm rolling my eyes. I just wanted to end on this. I have many, many more, but this one I wanted to be my nerd word for this segment. It's from Belgium, and their third place went to eggelwegel, which is a word for a passage for hedgehogs between gardens. Eggelwegel. The third most popular word in 2019 in Belgium.
But the most adorable word.
Yeah. I know.
Now, are these Love like it. Domesticated hedgehogs? Or are these wild hedgehogs?
I have no idea. Well, they must
be wild.
They must be wild.
Oh, it's adorable.
Yeah. Like, and with all the, you know, the climate emergency and the climate strikes and the, you know, flight shaming and everything. Eggelwegel.
Eggelwegel for the hedgehogs.
Yes, for the hedgehogs.
I have a question for you, Kirsten. Mm-hmm. So you were talking about all these end of the year lists.
Yeah.
Are you one of those people who believes that the decade ends on December 31st, 2020, and that's why you didn't bring any word of the decade lists to the table today?
Oh,
yes,
that's right. That's why.
So this relates to my nerd word, which is decade, and there's a bit of a debate on the internet right now, and some people say the decade ends on December 31st, 2019, and for others, they say it ends on December 31st, 2020. So I looked into this, because I was very curious, because I was like, what does decade actually mean? And so the truth is they're both a little bit right and they're both a little bit wrong. Everyone is wrong in the sense that there is no the decade. A decade is defined as any period of 10 years. So November 18th, 1928 to November 17th, 1938 is a valid decade as any. And on top of that, there's no organization, governmental or otherwise, which dictates an official decade. People commonly like the idea of the 60s or 70s or 80s. So most likely when people are referring to a decade ending, they mean one in which the group of 10 years is based on the 10 digits, such as 2010 to 2019, which is, of course, the correct use of the term decade. And you could even say the decade ends on December 31st, 2019, with the decade referring to the common use of the term. Where some people get persnickety on this about the term the decade is when they start mapping the common decade onto the Gregorian calendar. So if you count
persnickety is right.
Yes, yeah.
That's where I draw the line.
That's right.
The Gregorian calendar.
Because if you count the decades backwards, you know, 90s, 80s, 70s, etc., and you go all the way back to the beginning of the Gregorian calendar to the first aughts, you're left with a 9-year period because, fun fact, the Gregorian calendar starts at the year 1 and not the year 0, which is why people think that the decade ends on December 31st, 2020, which is true if your starting point is the beginning of the Gregorian calendar. And this type of decade actually has a special name. It's called the ordinal decade. And on December 31st, 2020, the 202nd ordinal decade will end. So one isn't wrong to say the decade will end on December 31st, 2020, but you're probably being a little unclear, what with the modern parlance being what it is. So you're probably better off saying the ordinal decade will end on December 21st, 2020.
But what do the Mayans think?
And is this altered at all by the lunar calendar?
Good advice, as always, from Alan.
Yeah. Gives me a lot to think about over the next little while. I could go next. My word brings us back to the world of Princess Bride, and my word is swashbuckler, a term that we've all heard. We've all heard it applied as a descriptor. I just never really thought what a swashbuckler was. So I looked it up. Interestingly enough, or not, it's made up of two words, the swash and the buckler. So swash means to make a noise like clashing swords, and a buckler was a small round shield. So swashbucklers are literally ones who make noise by striking their swords on their own or their opponent's shields. A vivid description of a swaggering ruffian, later extended to a flamboyant adventurer and often associated with pirates.
That's funny because swash to me doesn't sound like swords hitting. Shouldn't it be swock butler? Like swash.
Or clank.
Clank, yeah.
Interesting, fun story about making sword sounds is, again, from Cary Elwes's book. Apparently, they had to stop the actors from making sounds when they were fencing because they would just start doing that when they were practicing the fencing. And apparently this happened in the Star Wars movies too, where actors had to fight really hard not to make sounds when they were fighting with the lightsabers. So maybe actual pirates made sounds when they were sword fighting. So my nerd word for this month is harried. It has nothing to do with Harry and the Hendersons or Harry Potter. Lexico.com describes it as feeling strained as a result of having demands persistently made on one, harassed. Merriam-Webster says beset by problems, harassed. So you would think with all of that maybe harried is a form of harassed, but it isn't apparently because the root of harassed seems to be hairy. This meaning of the term dates from about 1609. And before that, the more common definition of it was to ravage, as in war, to devastate, as in troops ravage or harrying a countryside. This version goes from before 900 and apparently derives from the Old English Harrigian or Harrian, which is a derivative of here army. So it was literally the army coming here and laying waste. So a modern example of this is Prince Harry usually has a beard, right? So the very hairy Harry has been harried by the media. We're recording this the week before Christmas. The holidays can be a happy time for many, but it's not uncommon to feel the strains of many demands on one's time. So if you're feeling harried, it's okay to let people know you need a little more space and a little peace and quiet to manage your energies. Harried.
If only we had an eggle-veggle.
Oh,
and we could see the hedgehogs.
You could hide in your eggle-veggle and you wouldn't be so hairy.
Yeah, if you're feeling hairy, you could just go out and watch those hedgehogs going back and forth.
Between the gardens.
And unfortunately, we have to sign off for this month. So thank you very much, dear readers, for tuning into this. And this decade. Yes, this decade.
A decade. We always sign off at the end of a decade.
A decade. And this, our XXIV episode of the Time to Read podcast.
It's hard to believe we've been doing this for 10 years, you guys.
It's great to grow old around a table with you guys. In January, join us as we read Great House, a novel by Nicole Krauss. Get in on the conversation by finding us on Facebook or emailing us at wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca. We'd love it if you hit subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast service. And we'd love it even more if you were to give us a 5-star rating. And until the next decade, make sure you find
Time to Read.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Time to Read podcast. We were talking about The Princess Bride by William Goldman. Time to Read is a production of the Winnipeg Public Library. Our panel today included Alan Chorney, Dennis Penner, Kirsten Werman, and Trevor Lockhart. Erica will return in a future episode. Our webmaster is Aaron Seaburn. Our social media guru is Regan Brew. Audio production and music by Dennis Penner. Some of our comments today came from Adam Ziegler, Charlie Nellum, Ms. Diaz Menagerie, and Jamie Weebrook. You can be part of our show too. Email us at wpl-podcast@winnipeg.ca with suggestions for books that you'd like us to read and discuss, and comments and questions about the book we're reading for our next show. Visit us on the web at wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca. Check out our show notes with links to some of the things we talked about today, and take part in a discussion about the books we're reading. You can also join our Facebook group. Next month, we're reading Great House by Nicole Krauss. We're looking forward to hearing what you think about it. Missed you.
Yeah. It looks like during those time you were away, you just went around and collected nerd words.
I know.
What you are some traveled to Norway. You traveled to China. It was amazing.
Guys, what's your word of the year? Thanks. Okay, I got to go now. I got to get to Norway.